This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the woman Newsweek described as the most exciting individual in American theater. In her series of theater pieces, Anna Deavere Smith has been telling the complicated story of race in America. In her previous play, Fires in the Mirror, which was broadcast last year on public television, she took on the story of African Americans and Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn's Crown Heights. Now she's telling us the story of Los Angeles after the riots. Her piece, Twilight, is based on interviews with African Americans, whites, Latinos, and Koreans. Twilight is a series of monologues in which Smith, who is African American, portrays some of the people she interviewed. Her monologues are taken verbatim from the interviews. Some of the people she portrays are Rodney King's aunt, Daryl Gates, Reginald Denny, a Hollywood agent, and a Korean woman whose store was looted. Next week, she brings this piece to the Public Theater in New York for a month-long run. I spoke with her last summer, just after she premiered Twilight in Los Angeles. Before we talked, she performed an excerpt of the show.
This first character that I'm going to do is Mrs. Han, who is a Korean-American woman whose liquor store was burned down during the unrest in Los Angeles. Until last year, I thought America was the best. I still do. I don't deny that just because I am victim. But at the end of 92, when we were in such turmoil and we had so many financial problems and so many mental problems, I began to see that Koreans are completely left out of this society and we are nothing. Why? Is it because we are Korean? Is it because we have no politicians? Is it because we don't speak good English? Why? Why do we have to be left out? We don't qualify for medical treatment? No food stamp? No GR? No welfare? Anything? Many African Americans who never work get minimum amount of money to survive. We don't get any because we have a car and a house. And we are high taxpayers. Where do I find justice? Okay. Many African Americans probably think they won by the verdict. Many say only half, right? Justice was done. And I was sitting here watching them on television in the morning and all the day. And they were having a party. And they celebrated. All South Central, all the churches. And they said, well, finally, justice has been done in this society. But what about victims' rights? They destroyed many innocent Korean merchants to get their rights. Okay, they have a lot of respect, as I do, for Dr. Martin King. He is the only model of black community. I don't care, just Jackson. He is the model of nonviolence, and they would all like to be in his spirit. Then what about last year? They destroyed innocent people. And I wonder if that is really justice for them to get their rights in this way. I was swallowing the bitterness, sitting here alone and watching them. They were having so hilarious. But I was happy for them. And I was glad for them. At least they got something back. Okay, let's just forget about Korean victims or other victims who were destroyed by them. They fought for their rights for two centuries. And if they hadn't sacrificed, other minorities, Hispanic, Asian, would suffer more in the mainstream. That's why I understand and why I would like to be part of their enjoyment. I wish that black people and Korean people could live together. But after the riots, it's too much differences. That's why I have a mixed feeling about the verdict. The fire is still there. How do you call it? Igniting fire? It could burst out any time. And I call that piece Swallowing the Bitterness.
And I thank you so much for performing that excerpt. How did you find the woman whose voice you just did for us?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had two wonderful assistants from UCLA, two Korean-American women who are both graduate students at UCLA. And they went with me, which was very helpful. You know, it was very helpful to have with me Korean-speaking people. And also, I think just culturally, I learned that I couldn't walk as brazenly into all communities the way that I had been able to walk by myself in Crown Heights.
Why couldn't you?
It's much more complicated. It's just the racial terrain here in Los Angeles is much more complex, as we can see from her piece. I mean, I think that the question that's so interesting here is, you know, is that really justice that they got their rights in this way? And there's a degree on the other side to which many African-Americans, who do not feel that justice has been done, you know, that this is a Band-Aid, really. And many people who question whether justice can be done only in the courts, right? That, as Jesse Jackson said to me when I interviewed him, we have quiet, but we don't have justice. So it's a resounding, a very haunting question, I find, throughout my exploration of what happened in Los Angeles is what is justice and how do we find justice? But her question is it justice that they got their rights by burning things? Is a interesting question. And in fact, it's a very complicated piece to even do in Los Angeles because sometimes when I begin Mrs. Han, there's a lot of laughter.
Why is there laughter?
I don't know, and not that I can identify laughter by race by any means, but I think sometimes that laughter is coming from African Americans. When we had a group of young people, I believe it was young African Americans were laughing. They could be laughing at the way she talks, but there's also an intellectual response to her saying, we don't get any welfare because we have a car and a house and we are high taxpayers. People frequently laugh there. And it's a kind of like, ha ha, like a disbelief. And I think this shows us how complicated racial dynamics are, especially in these economic times. It's not us versus them. The us's and the them's are more varied than black and white, for one thing. And I think it's hard for people to put together who's us and who's them. But what we're finding out is us and them isn't a satisfactory way of looking at it, period.
My guest is Anna Deavere Smith. We're talking about her one-person show, Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anna Deavere Smith. We're talking about her show, Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. And in this show, she becomes many of the people who were caught up in the aftermath of the Rodney King verdict, including Rodney King's aunt, Reginald Denny, a Korean woman whose liquor store was looted. She plays Daryl Gates. She plays people from just all the different sides and all the different parts of the story. One of the things I find amazing about your work is this. Usually when you're an actor, you have to find and believe in the truth of the one character that you're playing. And even if that character is a villain, no matter how evil that character is, you have to find their truth and see the world through their eyes. What you do in your work is you don't just empathize with one character, whether that character is good or bad. You empathize with everybody. You put yourself into the body, into the thoughts and mind of each of the people that you do. And in a piece like Twilight, you're putting yourself into the mind of everybody from Daryl Gates to Reginald Denny to, you know, a Korean woman whose shop was looted to somebody who was empathizing with the looters. You know, you're everybody. And I'm wondering if it was hard for you to empathize that much in such a complicated crisis.
Well, it certainly was more complicated than Fires in the Mirror. The other thing is that, you see, with Fires in the Mirror, not just me, but the whole audience has at its fingertips and in its heart this incredible emotional resource about the Holocaust and about slavery. Even if people aren't black or Jewish, we have had enough exposure to it in culture to have emotional reactions to it. And once again, not that many of us, and certainly I did not know what many of the Korean Americans have come from who've come to this country. I mean, they themselves have come from slavery. They've come from a history of colonialism. It's a country, I mean, it's remarkable, as I was told by one of the people that I interviewed, that they even have a language anymore. And so I think empathy is a tricky word. I really want to look and see what the root of it is, because I'm not so sure what I do is empathy, the way the common walking man thinks that empathy, I suppose, is kind of feeling for another person. Because I'm an actress, I have been trained in ways to identify. And sometimes that identification is really a sensory identification that, you know, I might grab on to something that a police officer does. Maybe it's the way Daryl Gates sits that attracts me, that allows me to get a hold of an aspect of him. It's not just coming from the heart and the mind, if I'm clear, Terry.
Mm-hmm. What was it that you feel you got from Daryl Gates?
You mean when I interviewed him?
When you interviewed him, and what is it that you want to put across to us when you're on stage?
Well, it's changing in performance. Mm-hmm. What I was working on was, he says, what I choose to do, what I've chosen to do in the piece is a part of his interview where he talks about how he has suddenly become, he says, I am suddenly the symbol of police oppression in the United States, if not the world. Me. I am me. And he says that he asks the young people who consider him this symbol of oppression, and I ask him, where did you get that idea? I mean, who told you that? You don't know me. You never talked to me. 43 years in law enforcement, nobody's ever said that about me. No one. And suddenly, I am the symbol of police oppression. It's a tough thing to deal with. Well, for a long time, I was connecting to his, his shock, you know, in the use of the word sudden. But what I'm beginning to remember is the amount of charm that he had throughout the interview. And so, at least in my last performance, what I'm performing is a much less desperate, much more easygoing guy who even sees the humor in this suddenness.
I thought you were connecting, too, to a certain amount of self-delusion, the sense of, like, who, me? Suddenly they see me as being... when the L.A. Police Department had such a bad reputation for so long.
Yeah, but... okay, but that would be a dangerous place for me to go. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, tell me why.
Well, because that's what we would call, in traditional sense, judgment.
Right.
And that would keep me from getting to whatever is real. That kind of judgment would keep me from getting to what is real.
Now, did you talk to any...
And every human being has a level of reality, right? Mm-hmm. And so my job is to tease through all of the exteriors to find that. And, you know, on the other side, people who we may automatically take on as our heroes, right? It's even those people, is to tease through all of that, you know, all of that that we worship, to find what's real is what my job has to be.
Well, that leads to something I was going to ask you, which is, what do you think it is that is different from watching you become these people than it is watching them be themselves? I always ask myself, when I see you perform, why is it different watching you be them? Why do I get a layer of meaning watching you do them that I wouldn't get from just watching them?
I think we are all doing that when we meet people. We are constructing a reality of that person. It's just that in art, we abstract that reality, and it seems to be have a greater level of meaning because there's a more obvious convergence of that person's meaning and my level of meaning on them. But what I think that I have in common with the people that I'm interviewing, or what I try to reenact, is the process of them coming into their own authorship. So what I try to do in performance is to allow not just the words to come through or the feeling to come through, but the actual activity of coming up with the words to come through. And, you know, the more I perform, the more I work on trying to get the process of that available to the audience so that they can watch the train of thought that I watch when I'm watching a person talk to me. But I must say, in Los Angeles, this was a kind of also a fascinating process, because people, nobody in this town said what I expected them to say. Everybody shocked me. And ultimately, I began to talk about the twists and turns and the unexpected that I found in everyone's speech. And also, the inability to speak, the inability to complete sentences was very obvious here. And I think that's because people, number one, don't fully know what to make of this. And number two, it's encouraging that I think people are willing to give up, you know, old ways of thinking and actually try to make up something in front of a stranger, which is what they were doing in front of me.
Well, who were some of the people who shocked you, and what shocked you about what they said? Surprised you, I should say.
Reginald Denny stunned the living daylights out of me. Mm-hmm. I would never have expected him. And I still can't make full sense for you of what is stunning about it, except that I think he has a message for the country at large. I'd be happy to do part of,
would you please?
Of Reginald for you, and then we'll see what you think, and we could talk about it a little bit.
Great.
This will be a little rough because I'm not going to take it from the beginning, but I'm going into the middle of it. And I asked him what happened, you know, when he got beat up, and we're going to come into the middle of it. At this point, he's talking about when he first realized something was wrong out there on Florence and Normandy. And I guess you talk about your heart skips a beat. When I realized something was wrong was when they bashed in the right window of my truck. And that's the end of what I remember for 5 or 6 days when I woke up in Daniel Freeman Hospital. And they say I was in a coma. And I was just trying to figure out, how did I get here? And they didn't tell me there was a riot or anything. And I guess that was something the doctors didn't think I really needed to know. And I was on morphine for pain. So it was a really interesting time. And I've never been in an operating room before. And I mean, it's just like a scene from a movie. You know how they flip those big lights on? They're really in there. And so I was just thinking, God, and the doctors with masks on and stuff. And I guess when it started to dawn on me that something big must have happened was when really important people wanted to come by and say hi. And one of the first persons I was aware of who came to see me was Reverend Jesse Jackson. And I thought, not this guy. I mean, he has better things to do than to be hanging out at Daniel Freeman Hospital. That's the dude I seen on TV all the time. And then Arsenio Hall came to see me, and that's when I started to get it. And they still wouldn't let me watch it on TV, though. They really controlled that remote control thing. They just kept it on the movie channel. And I guess if it hadn't have been for me seeing some of the stuff, that was my one blessing, is I didn't remember a thing. If I didn't see some of the stuff, like climbing back into the truck, or the things that Titus and Terry and Bobby and Lee, those are the guys that came to my rescue, stuff they were telling me, I never would have known. And Terry, she came to the hospital as a kind of a surprise guest visit, and that was a really interesting and emotional time. I mean, how do you say that someone saved my life? I mean, how can I express enough thanks for them actually risking their neck for me? And I was kind of afraid isn't the word, but awkward, meeting the people who saved me, and finally I did. And it wasn't like meeting a stranger, it was like meeting a buddy. We all had this weird common thread in our lives. I mean, this was an extraordinary event. The guys up in the helicopter, they stuck with it, and then the four guys who seen it on TV and ran out and came to my rescue. And they told me I drove the truck for about 100 feet, but I was totally unconscious of everything I was seeing or doing. Because, well, I've been driving semis for 17 years now since I got out of high school, and it doesn't take much brains to do it. I guess it's kind of second nature. But Bobby, he tells me that he saw that that I was getting nowhere fast, so he just said enough's enough and jumped in and scooted me over. And by then it was a pretty bloody mess. I mean, I seen pictures of myself when I went into to surgery, and it was just blood and glass, and they cut off my hair and showed it to me in a plastic bag, and it was just long hair and glass and blood. And Lee Ewell, I mean, that's a woman. And she tells me that she just kind of cradled me. And there's not a passenger seat in the truck, so I was down in the middle of the floor on my knees. And Lee's just covered in blood. And Titus, he's on the side because the windshield was so broken that Bobby couldn't see to drive. So Titus was on the running board telling Bobby where to drive. And Terry, Titus's girlfriend, she was out in front of the truck weaving through traffic, dodging towards cars, telling him to clear the path. And the next stop, Daniel Freeman Hospital. And Terry, in that piece, I think, is a very unexpected humanity. Number one, I think a lot of people didn't expect Reginald Denny to be as empty of blame as he seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
But moreover, it is a kind of a symbol for me about where we are right now in the country in terms of race relations and where we have to get to, where we have to go. And as I rehearsed, particularly the section where he says, there's a weird common thread in our lives, I began to think of our journey to find a way of living together in our differences as a kind of a coming into consciousness, which is not unlike his coming into consciousness in that hospital. I don't think we're still in full consciousness. And to get to full consciousness, we're going to have to wake up to the fact that we have been in a tragedy, which is as graphic as his tragedy of waking up with his jaw sewn together and, you know, major brain surgery and everything else. And that tragedy is racism. And it's taking a long time for us to come into consciousness because it's a painful coming into consciousness. And we've used many different kinds of drugs, morphine, metaphorically speaking, and everything else to make it easy for ourselves. But there's no easy coming.
Anna Deavere Smith will perform Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992, at the Public Theater in Manhattan from March 8th through April 3rd. Our interview was recorded last July after the premiere of the show in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.